Hi and welcome back. I'm Patrick Polk and you're listening to The Rules of Investing. This week on the podcast, I'll be talking to Marcus Padley, Director of Marcus Today, one of Australia's most popular stock market newsletters. In addition to the newsletter and advising private clients, Marcus also runs the Marcus Today Fund. In this week's episode, we'll discuss what motivated him to start Marcus Today in the first place, his best ideas for finding outperformers this reporting season, and why the mantra of buy and hold for the long term is wrong. Finally, if you're loving The Rules of Investing, then why not tell someone about it? Pick your favourite episode and send it to a friend, or just head on over to iTunes and hit the subscribe button. Either way, you're helping to increase the profile of the podcast and therefore the quality of the guests that I can bring to you. Well, that's it for now. I hope you enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to the show. My guest today is Marcus Padley. Marcus is the founder and director of Marcus Today, one of Australia's longest running stock market newsletters. Before starting Marcus Today, he was a stockbroker at ABN AMRO after immigrating from England in 94. He has nearly 40 years experience in financial markets and he's one of the most popular authors on Livewire. Marcus, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Patrick.
It's good to have you here this morning. It's been a long time coming, having you on the podcast.
Yes, good. Okay, well, let's see how we go.
I saw recently on LinkedIn that it's been 21 years recently since you started Marcus Today. Obviously, there's been a few ups and downs in the stock market in the time since then. But what made you actually want to start Marcus Today in the first place?
Well, it sort of happened by accident, Patrick. I was institutional stockbroking, talking to fund managers. I was doing that in London, doing it for 16 years before I got here. And then I worked in institutional broking here, and we floated Telstra, made an absolute fortune at ABN AMRO. And BZW got upset with that, so they went and bought ABN AMRO, and I got offered redundancy or carry on working at BZW, which I'm glad I didn't. I took the redundancy and moved into retail broking at Bell Potter. And when I did, I was used to an institutional level of service for clients. And on a retail desk, when you're stockbroking, it's really a lot of it's left up to you what ideas you have. And so I, on the advice of Andrew Bell, fabulous chap, who told me the way to do stockbroking is to, one, find a client, and two, find a stock. And I had one client, which was my brother-in-law, who had $10,000. I thought, well, I'll start with him. And I discovered in 1998, and you can imagine in those days, email was just beginning. Everyone takes it for granted now. But it was just beginning, and I discovered the BCC box on Outlook, which was the most marvelous innovation. And you had to click about three times to find it, so nobody really knew what it was. But I realized I could put in all my clients' email addresses, and they wouldn't know who else was getting the email. It looked like a personal email. So I put my brother-in-law in the BCC box, and he didn't know that I wasn't sending it to 1,000 people. And in the subject line that day, I wrote, trading idea in capitals, trading ideas today, Marcus's trading ideas, today's ideas, Marcus's ideas. And in the end, I just wrote Marcus Today in capital letters in the subject line. And the newsletter was born. And within, it was basically designed to educate my brother-in-law and also to communicate trading ideas so I could do business. And within a short period of time, I had thousands of people in the BCC box. They'd all, can we get your trading ideas? One day I just sent an email saying, if you want to continue to receive this, because all these people weren't trading with me, then you need to pay me $250. And I remember walking down to the bank with one $250 check thinking, if I don't get another one of these, I'm going to be writing for this bugger for a whole year for $250. And anyway, next week there were two or three checks, and then it grew till eventually it sort of dwarfed the broking, quite honestly. It was perfect timing. 98 was beginning of the internet, beginning of online broking, beginning of people empowering themselves in the stock market, the end of the elitist idea that you couldn't deal unless you had a stock broker. It was the growth in self-managed super funds, basically people wanted information. The internet had provided the means for it, and I was there right at the beginning. I think I even preceded Renny Rivkin, who in I have a few thousand subscribers. I think he went to the most subscribers of any newsletter in a very short period of time, about 28,000, charging $500. It sort of works out at $14 million a year. You wonder why he's on a yacht in the middle of Sydney. But he did the whole cycle in a few years. I'm still on the upcycle at the moment.
You must have come across some pretty interesting situations and people. And I'm curious, what was the most surprising thing you've found since you've been managing retail clients?
It is how much selling there is. I think one of the things that rather disappoints me and motivates me is that a lot of the finance industry and a lot of investment is done with a message to try and dumb down the client. Really, the finance industry's game is to get a client to buy a product and keep them in it. And the way to keep clients in a product is to project optimism, which is why you'll find all the major economists and strategists of all the major banks and fund managers are there to promote confidence in their client base. If they were to say, if one of them was to suddenly make the call that the market is going to fall, they would get a phone call from every single advisor who'd sold a product the day before on stock market optimism, which is their job. There is this, the most disappointing and, but good for me because my brand is telling it as it is, the most disappointing thing to me over the years has been that people have bought into the messages that they send, the messages of it'll be all right in the end, it always goes up, set and forget. All things which don't suit the client, they suit the financial product seller. The idea is to keep you in. I've done courses on how to sell financial products. The most important ingredient is confidence. You have to give your clients confidence. They'll buy pretty much anything. I could sell anything to anyone. Whether I could do that morally or not is a different question. I feel a large part of the industry is selling, and I don't think a lot of the clients realise it.
Well, perhaps, I guess we'll find out, but perhaps that is actually a segue into our next question. There's certainly a view out there that's quite popular in this day and age, particularly in the world of people like Warren Buffett, which says that you can't time the market. It's either impossible or too difficult and shouldn't be attempted by most investors. Now, I know your opinion differs slightly there to that one. So I'm curious, could you make your case for timing stocks and markets?
Well, I think you have to. If you consider the long-term annual return since my dad was born 75 years ago from the All Ordinaries before dividends is about 5.64%. Inflation over that period has been about 4 point something. You take that off, you're really mucking about here for a 1.5% return per annum. And that's before you take off dealing costs, financial planners fees, fund managers fees, the index fudge. Truth is, returns from the market over the long period of time are somewhere around zero, possibly even negative, in real terms, post-inflation, post-costs. If you were to tell people that and they accepted it, they would be realizing that you can't just sit in the market long-term, which is what everybody wants you to do. You have to time it. The most marvelous thing about the stock market is occasionally it loses its head. And as we saw prior to 1987, the market was up over 100% in the year before the 87 crash. If you look at the run-up to the GFC, these were most marvelous, parabolic, mindless moments. But the averages over the long term include all those moments. You have to be in for those moments. If you don't do some sort of timing, you are going to wear all the other side of that stupidity when the market falls over. And we are now 10 years after the GFC, and we're still, 15% below the level of the market at the top. If you look at 1987, it took 9 years for the market to recover its levels. Of course, this doesn't include dividends, so you could argue something else. But if you look at Japan, for instance, in 1989, I think their index was about 36,000. It's about 24,000 now. You cannot bury your head in the sand and suggest that you can't time stocks and the market, because unless you do, you're going to go nowhere. You're going to be opening that envelope at the end of every year from your big fund manager and wondering why you haven't really made any progress and why there are a load of other people flying around in BMWs and Teslas. The reason is because you have to add more than just allowing people to enter the market. That is not a value-added service. But the concept that you can't time the market is there's a book written, I think A Random Walk on Wall Street was one of them, which says you can't time the market. There are financial product sellers all over the world holding on to this and waving it, because it absolves them from ever trying or ever giving any hard advice on when. And it's a great shame because it's all part of the sales process.
Well, that tells us a bit of the why. Let's get into the how. What are some of the tools that you use in order to achieve that timing, whether it be on a stock level or on a broader market level? Where do you start when you're trying to work out the when of when to buy and when to sell?
Well, I think you have to pay some attention. There are a load of steps, but you have to pay some attention to the amount of risk you're taking. So I always start with which list of stocks. Now, I run a fund, about 40 million in the fund. It's tiny by market standards. We have the ability to own about 50 stocks. So naturally, I'm limited to maximum 50 stocks. The performance or outperformance of the market is going to be helped enormously by what's on that list. You can't have a random list. So we can talk about timing, but the reality is that the long-term performance of a fund is going to depend on a lot of fundamental work to start with. After that, you can start to try and time things. Now, there is no other way to gauge it than to look at trend. Now, I know a whole cohort of value investors will now be having a great giggle, but I will have a good giggle at you guys who think that all you have to do with all your brains and cleverness, you assess what the value of a company is, buy it, and hope that at some point in the future, value will show up in the share price. Now, I ask you, with all your brains and cleverness, how can you be so stupid as to ignore half the tools that you could possibly use to try and get the process of buying shares low and selling them high? How can you ignore technical analysis? And I'll tell you why you do. Because if you read The Intelligent Investor, a book which sits on the bookshelf of every retiree with the first five pages read, in page two, can you believe it? On page two, there is a line where Benjamin Graham has written something which has divided the technical and fundamental world forever. It says something to the effect that trying to time the market doesn't work and is fallacious. Now, look at that. That's on page two. When he wrote those words, he divided technical traders from fundamental people, and some of you have never come back across the boundary. And really, I ask you, this is a difficult task trying to get share prices right. Why wouldn't you use every tool at your disposal? Because I can tell you from my own experience, it does work.
It's funny, you see a lot of investors out there who are happy to use both technical and fundamental. Certainly not the majority, but there's a lot of investors who are happy to use both. And there's plenty of investors out there that will rely purely on fundamental analysis, as you pointed out. What you very rarely see is anybody who relies purely on technical analysis, it's in the vast majority of the cases, I think it's as you described, where you've got built the fundamental view of the stock to begin with, and then overlaying the technical analysis on top of that. And I think you're right. There's definitely a view that the two are mutually exclusive for a lot of investors, but the people I've seen who have used both of them well are those who have managed to combine them.
I would say, and the answer to that is, I would say that 80% of making money, and this is a big difference, Patrick, making money with other people's money, which is what I have to do, rather than making money with your own money where you are only to blame or you're only responsible for yourself, very different. So 80% of what I do would be based around picking this list of stocks, fundamental stocks, fundamentally reliable stocks is possibly the most important element to it. You want reliable earnings, reliable dividends. Otherwise, you really are guessing. So 80% of that would be 80% of the process when you're looking after other people's money, dealing with a lot of money, has to go down to fundamental research. But then to ignore the timing of when you buy those stocks, when you sell those stocks, is, I think, foolish. All of those quality stocks, so you take in the market, you can bore yourself silly if you want to, buying the likes of utilities, infrastructure, banks. I mean, we hold them. They're a foundation, volatility-reducing stocks. But the value add is when you come to identify growth stocks within the big stocks. So let's look. If you look at the top 50 stocks, you'd be looking at things like Cochlear, CSL, Macquarie, Aristocrat Leisure, Treasury Wine Estates, all large quality stocks. And they will hopefully trend, and I look at trend relative to the market. I want to see a long-term history of outperforming the market. You can go through the top 50, identify those stocks very, very quickly. And then the timing is about when you buy those. Now, they occasionally go parabolic and you just have to stand back. You don't buy Domino's Pizza on a PE of 75 times. But when a stock like Cochlear or CSL or Aristocrat Leisure, which they have done just recently, fall 30%, 25 to 30% when the market fell 15%, that's an opportunity. And that's where timing comes in. It's only 20% of the longer term equation, but it is a very important part of it.
About 12 months ago, maybe a little bit longer, you wrote an article for Livewire called Going with the Flow, which was very popular at the time. And you talked about the concept of flow trading. I was wondering if you could maybe explain just in a little bit of briefness what broadly flow trading is and how does it fit in with your strategy and your process?
It's not, I would call it flow analysis. It is, there is lots of data available to you when you're buying a stock, particularly a mid-cap and small stock that you need to have a look at. There is no point buying a stock where one boutique fund manager holds 10 to 15% of it and they've started selling. Now, you can operate through Reuters or Bloomberg. It'll cost you a lot of money if you're a retail investor. But those systems do allow you to watch what fund managers are doing with particular stocks. So I can bang up a particular stock and see who the big fund managers are and what their recent trades were. Whether only through substantial shareholder notices, you'd have to do it manually, take a long time. But I can see where they've been selling. When you've got a very large shareholder selling, it doesn't matter what the fundamentals are. It doesn't matter what the market's doing. That guy is going to, or girl, is going to hold the price down. So flow analysis is working out what people are doing. Quite easy on our systems to have a look at what the top 20 shareholders hold and whether they've been buyers or sellers recently. There's a very good website to manage another one, which is director shareholdings. You want to see what directors are doing. It doesn't always matter. 99% of trades are buys, but you do want to see when they're doing large sales. And maybe not because there's something wrong with the company. It may well be they're paying for a new house or something. So they're selling some shares. But you do want to, it will affect market sentiment. So you want to know what directors' shareholdings are doing. There's a great website called Market Index. You can do that through. Then there is shorting. Occasionally, the stocks get, you do not want to be in a stock that is being targeted with shorting. The fundamentals may be fabulous, but if the shorters are in and it's the stock du jour to short, you're going to be in the wrong stock. You can monitor that through a great website called Shortman. Both those websites are free. Apart from top 20 shareholders, I can have a look at fund managers on my systems and see what they've recently bought. They are putting out substantial shareholders notices as well. You want to keep an eye on which fund managers are doing what. Every fund manager like myself, although they would not dare to admit it, monitor all the other fund managers as well, particularly the ones they think are particularly good. And the ones that move around in the mid-cap space, because they move prices, and we all monitor each other to see who's doing what. And a lot of the time, you will be watching some of those boutique, popular, successful fund managers just to see what their ideas are, because you can adopt them yourself.
So when you're looking through Shortman, are you looking for opportunities on both sides? Are you looking for potential short squeezes as well?
No, absolutely not. I would only ever use all those things, top 20 shareholders, short selling, direct to shareholders, and monitoring the fund manager. I do it as a check when I'm looking at a new stock and looking at the timing of something like buying a big quality stock. I'd also add on to that, if I'm looking at a CSL or a Cochlear to try and decide whether it's now a buy after a 30% fall, I'd also look at all the broker research as well. There's a fabulous website, FN Arena, which monitors broker research, and they are telling you the next day what research has been done on the stock the day before, on an event the day before. All those things I'd monitor to decide on something I'd more fundamentally picked up on. I wouldn't really be scanning them for ideas, maybe some of the fund manager movements, but that's about all.
Well, we're coming into February very fast now, which is a bit of a surprise. It feels like we only just got back from holidays at New Year's, but obviously, earnings season's about to get underway. In fact, I think we actually had our first half-yearly reports come through today. So I know earnings season's always a big time for fund managers and stockbrokers and everyone in the market. So I'm curious, have you got a list of potential candidates that might be looking to beat expectations this earnings season?
I think you're asking the wrong question, Patrick. You should be asking the question, do you think there are some stocks which will go up on results? Because something I think a lot of investors have to take on board is what moves a share price. And if you look at the top 10 performing stocks every year and the bottom 10 performing stocks every year and ask why are they the top and bottom performing stocks, say in the top 100, you can see that something happened that wasn't expected. That's why share prices move. So if BHP is expected to make $5 billion this year and it makes $5 billion, the share price won't move. You won't make any money out of stocks doing exactly what it's expected. In fact, their share prices will flatline. What moves share prices is things that are unexpected. So it's not a question of a company beating expectations. It's really a question of whether the share price will go up, because some companies can beat expectations, but the share price gets absolutely collapsed.
Sorry, could I just clarify, just to be clear, are we talking about the consensus analyst expectations here? Or are you talking about market expectations as a more, you know, kind of broad and fuzzy term?
No, it would be analyst expectations. And with electronic trading, which has become a much lower margin business and is less pursued, is absolutely true that the initial reactions on results these days can be extremely savage, only to reverse maybe later. But it has become, results season has become like being on a battlefield wearing an orange vest in the middle of an artillery barrage, and you never quite know when you're going to get blown up. So what I tend to do, or have done in the past, unless I'm super confident, I'm probably easing out of stocks rather than in, because I would prefer, if say we were looking at the very popular stock Afterpay at the moment, results coming up, they're going to get savaged if they don't do well, especially if the price has risen into results, and they are going to fly if they do well. But it's a moment of volatility that you don't really want to put other people's money in front of, quite honestly. So you would tend to exit mid-cap, small caps over results season if you're uncertain, especially if the share price is trending down into the results. It's the market telling you something. So it's about what I probably would feel safe holding at the moment. It's also about what themes go into results. So at the moment, the housing market's had a terrible last 6 months or so, which is the period they're reporting. So I don't think housing stocks, housing-related stocks, are going to do terribly well. Resources have had a terrible year last year. If you look at metal prices, they're down average 18%. So the results now are being reported for that six-month period. Yes, the stocks are going up now as the iron ore price goes up, but resources probably not going to be great. Oil price fell 41% in the last 6 months or so. It's up 19% since, but that probably won't look good. And I'd also be avoiding some of the China-facing stocks, where clearly, from what's happening in the States, a lot of companies who have made the China bet are now seeing a soggy economy over there. In terms of what stocks I like, I think on the flip side of the oil equation, Qantas should do quite well. I was very taken with the Hearts and Minds presentation of one of the attendees who decided that Qantas was the cheapest stock in the Australian market. Well, we'll see if he's right. But with the oil price falling over last year, they should have done really rather well. I think the ASX is a machine which will continue to bang along.
You're talking about ASX, the stock there, not the market?
Yes. Macquarie, it doesn't have results now, but next quarter. Macquarie is a stock that consistently tends to beat, or rather cleverly manage, lower expectations before results. And I also think the banks, if you identify sectors that are in massive sentiment holes, this is one, insurance is another. They don't have to do a lot to see the share price rise on results. And I really don't see that the banks the expectations are so low, they're very easy to beat.
Yeah, insurance has been a tough market for investors in Australia the last few years. There's certainly been a lot of head fakes at a recovery for that industry. So it should be interesting to see how that plays out.
Yes, we've never really... The insurance companies have never been on my list. I think we've traded them a few times when they looked to be in a sentiment hole just recently. IAG, for instance, picked up quite rapidly. But they don't make the list for the long term, no.
Well, you mentioned a few seconds ago that housing's had a pretty tough 6 months, and certainly the early data from January appears to be suggesting that it could be more of the same in the early part of this year. Now, I know you said it was not all that long ago you mentioned that you thought the housing market is close to finding a bottom. So is that still your view?
Very much so. I think APRA has tried to blow the froth off the property market, the apartment market in particular, the Chinese buyers all over a year ago. And in a combination with the Royal Commission, their lending restrictions and the Royal Commission, which has distracted the banks and made them pull their heads in, the banks have been paralysed. The approval process for a house has gone from 2 to 3 weeks to 5 to 8 weeks. And in trying to blow the froth off, I think they've hurt the core. And if you look at the peak to trough house price fall since in this recent correction, it's about 9.6% in Sydney, which is as bad as it's ever been from peak to trough, going back to, and the last time it did that was in a recession in 1990. We've got no recession. We've got the economy banging along. And I think APRA have made a huge mistake and have overcooked it. And noticeably, I wrote an article about this in December, and that week, APRA lifted their lending restrictions because I believe the RBA would have got spooked by the popular commentary at the time, which is the housing market's going to cause a recession. It should be the other way around, and only ever would be the other way around. But the idea is that the housing market was going to cause a recession. I imagine the RBA had a word with somebody who had a word with the APRA, who said our lending restrictions were only ever intended to be temporary. And lo and behold, they've come off. So I do think we've probably seen the worst of it on the housing price trend. The rate of fall is going to narrow, probably might still see a fall this year. But I do believe we're somewhere near the bottom. If I was out there looking to buy property at the moment, I think your timing's pretty good.
Playing devil's advocate here for a second. Now, you mentioned that housing doesn't generally cause recessions. It's the other way around. Usually recession causes a housing fall. I'm just curious to get your take on the GFC.
I've got an opinion on that as well, Patrick.
on the GFC and the subprime crisis in the US, do you think that there was something else going on there? Because I think the generally accepted opinion is usually that the subprime crisis in the US caused the recession there. So I'm just curious your take on that.
I can't argue with you. When you knock holes in the balance sheets of the world's biggest financial institutions, which happens to be property related, you know, they could have been lending for other activities and got that wrong. It happened to be housing related. And I don't think that was so much a housing market price issue so much as a ridiculous system of allowing you to walk away and hand the keys back if the house is worth less than the mortgage. I mean, that's a put option on property. Thank you very much. No wonder it got abused. But yes, of course, when you get a massive seismic event like that, it's going to impact the economy. But I don't see anything like that happening in Australia. The banks are already, if anything, underlending, being too tight with their lending. They've got huge tier one capital ratios. The property market sees these perennial scares, usually from outsiders. Americans, I think, wrote that report last year, which scared everybody. But at the end of the day, I'm in my house forever. As far as I can see, I think the core of the Australian property market is fine, and the core of the Australian property market could see really quite a big correction. No one really care except the people who are speculating. But I'm reasonably comfortable with the housing market until it goes wrong, and I don't see it going wrong for the moment.
There's a pretty major event going on in the world right now, but it's kind of off the radar of a lot of Australian investors, or at least maybe not off the radar, but perhaps not interesting them as much as it should. But I'd be curious to, as a British expat, to get your opinion on the situation with Brexit there. Obviously, Theresa May's deal fell through, didn't manage to make it through the parliament there, and it's all a bit up in arms at the moment. Is the UK an investable place at the moment?
Very much so. I think there's a great opportunity. I mean, I don't do international investment, but we do have some Australian listed stocks that are exposed to the UK. I think it will sort itself out. I've forever been aware, but particularly over issues like Trump and Brexit and trade talks, how the headlines will over-exaggerate enormously. For instance, I wrote last week, AMP falls 7% on a profit warning. I think the headline in the, I won't name which publication, was AMP smashed. And that's sort of how I feel the market has taken Brexit as well, that they have constantly dwelled on the negative headlines. Inspired by or annoyed by this tone, rang a few of my colleagues in the City of London recently. And the message from them was, this is not about politics. If you remember, Corbyn had a no-confidence vote in Theresa May. It was never going to get up because nobody wants a change of government. They are disagreeing over Brexit. And the Tories are still 8% ahead in the latest poll. So this is not about politics. This is about getting out of Europe. And it's about not being bent over by the EU. The attitude of a lot of English people towards Europe is that we're being dictated to by overpaid, unelected what do you call them? Officials? Bureaucrats. There you go. Well done, Patrick. By bureaucrats. And that they don't need that anymore. They want out, but they don't want it on the current terms. So it's all about negotiating those terms. The brinkmanship of Corbyn has pushed a lack of agreement to the last minute. But the moment that no confidence was out of the way, they're all working together to come to some sort of deal. I think you'll find that Article 52 is suspended for Article 50 is suspended for a couple of weeks whilst they put a deal on the table that can then be negotiated. Then you'll find it's delayed 2 or 3 months and they'll sort something out. And at the end of the day, Britain, as an Englishman, Britain will survive very well on its own. It's a massive trading partner with the EU. They can't afford to put them offside. They can't afford to go into a tariff war with the UK because they'll get smashed. And the UK will be very happy to negotiate its own trade deals with the US, with Europe, with China, with Australia. And will have its own solid feet to stand on when it does that. So there may be short-term issues. There certainly would have been if there was a no-deal exit. There may be issues. But in the long term, this is what England wants to do, and they have all the ingredients they need to make a success of it, and I think they will.
As you mentioned there, there's a few stocks on the ASX that are heavily exposed to Britain and even some that are almost entirely British businesses. I'm curious, are there any particular ones you'd single out as being worth a look at the moment?
The most obvious one to me, which is a big part of our portfolio and I think is a perennial outperformer until it isn't, is Macquarie, a big exposure in the UK. But the most obvious ones are, or the most obvious one in particular is Janus Henderson, which is a financial group. They have their quote here, but the quote here is just translated from the UK quote. So the Australian price is a reflection of the currency as well. And so if the British pound goes up, the price here is going to go up. So the share price in the UK could stay dead still and the share price here would go up. And I think one of the most obvious outcomes of a decent exit from the EU is that the currency will recover because that's in the sentiment hole as well. I think as well at that point, Janus Henderson is in a sentiment hole here because it's perceived as a UK stock, and I think that will reverse as well. The other obvious one there is CYBG or the old Clydesdale Bank, and Macquarie will be the other. There are lots of other companies with businesses in the UK like Iris and Premium and some of the mid-caps, but really those are the majors.
Excellent. Well, that's the main part of our interview, but if you want to hang around for another couple of minutes, we've got a few regular questions I like to go over with all my guests and get their view. Excellent. Alrighty. So first of all, could you share with us something that you've read recently? It could be a book, an article, or a piece of research that really impressed you, really blew you away.
I love the futurists and I love the big ideas that won't make anybody any money and you'll sink a fortune trying to invest in them, but they are fabulous ideas. And one of the concepts that got me was the idea, which of course is Elon Musk sourced, is the idea that electricity will one day be free. We don't yet have the technology to collect, store the power of the sun. You've got this massive battery up there. And we are not yet, surprisingly, at a point of being able to utilize it as well as we could. Not only will that mean everybody with roof tiles that collect energy and everyone being self-sufficient, but when it's free, it will change the world because of water. And desalination plants can't be turned on because they're so ridiculously expensive. But when electricity is free, as long as you can build a long enough pipeline, you're going to be able to cultivate anywhere in the country. The seasons will disappear. The idea of Australian farmers having good seasons, bad seasons, kicking dust one year, being flooded the next, will disappear. Well, they might still get flooded. And imagine what that would do on a global scale. If you could now cultivate any area of land. And if you've ever flown over the border between Mexico and the US, you'll see running up to Mexico, it's sand, 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 border, irrigation, green. Looks like a golf course. And clearly the difference is provision of water. And if electricity can do that, then we are going to be in a completely new world of being able to grow anything, anywhere, anytime. And everything will be a heck of a lot cheaper because of it as well.
That sounds pretty amazing. I certainly hope I live to see that. Yeah, I was actually at San Diego, which is, of course, just on the US side of the border there. I was talking to a gentleman from San Diego a month or two ago, and he said in 12 months, they'd had 3 inches of rain there, which is just absolutely incredible. It's such a dry place. It's one of the driest cities on Earth. But let's go back in time to when you were finishing school or university. If you could give yourself a single piece of investing advice, what would it be?
Investing advice. Invest in your brain. Don't invest in the stock market. The sales process starts very early, suggesting that you should show an interest in the stock market from day one. I have seen very young people in the talks I give thinking that this is how they are going to make their living. The stock market is there for people to look after money that they've made. As a young person, your job is to make the money first. And this is the message to my children, is invest in your brain, your career. Make an effort. I don't admire anybody who's intelligent. I admire people who wake up in the morning and move their arms and legs. That's a Barassi quote. And this is certainly true, I think, for all young people. The stock market is not going to sort you out financially. You are. And the lowest risk investment you can possibly make is in yourself, because you can contain every risk of what you do, rather than leave it in the hands of some incompetent MD of some listed company that nobody's ever heard of. So I would say to you, yes, invest in yourself. And along those lines, I wish someone had said to me as I left school, do what you enjoy, because you will not succeed if you don't. And I went and did law after university. I had no ambition to do law. My brother had done medicine. My grades were good. I could do whatever I want. And I had this momentary idea I wanted to do law, when in fact maths, physics and chemistry fascinated me. And I should have gone and done that. A disaster. So kids, do what you enjoy. You will succeed at it. You'll never succeed at something you don't want to do.
It's pretty solid advice. There's not many pieces of advice that you can say are universally applicable, but I think that's got to be one of them.
Absolutely.
All right, one more for you. Hypothetically, if the market was going to close for the next 5 years, starting from tomorrow, and you could only own shares in a single company, what would the company be?
I would choose Macquarie. I think I've held Macquarie for 5 years already. It's done marvellously for me. When the market loses its head, Macquarie's share price loses its head as well. There are moments where it falls over, but I do believe, because they once rejected me at interview, that they have some very brainy people, and I invest in brains, and it certainly seems to turn up in the P&L at the same time. So well done for rejecting me, Macquarie, I think you are the stock for the next 5 years.
Excellent. Well, look, Marcus, thanks so much for coming on the show. It's been great to hear your thoughts and get your insights into investing and the markets.
It's been great. Thanks, Patrick.